Hello, my name is Marianne DeClay. I am a White Mountain Apache from the Fort Apache Tribe in Arizona. I am currently living in Bismarck, North Dakota. I've been here for about approximately 4 years. I have two children. One is a 6-year-old, and my baby is 2 years old. I have a husband who is Jean DeClay. I am in the business administration program here at United Tribes. I'll be graduating in May with my Bachelor's of Science. I've been on the president's list for the last 4 years. I'm on the American Indian Business Leaders. I am the vice president for the ABLE program of public outreach and marketing. And I am also a student, I guess you would say student advisor for the, what do you call it, campus safety program. And then I also helped out with the tribal, what do you call it, the tribal leader summit. I did that, also helped out with that. And
And so you told us basically your profile, and just for us to get familiar with you a little bit, your background and things, and it's all very positive. You have a family, you're very family orientated. How about some of the career potential? What are some of the aspirations that you have?
I will be taking the LSAT test in June, on the 8th of June. That's what I'm currently studying for right now. I was advised by one of my friends who's a lawyer that I should take it in October since I'll be graduating in May. And she was telling me that I only have a month to study it for the test, but I know that I can do it. I know that if I put my mind to it, I'll be able to pass it or actually get higher grades. So I just went ahead and enrolled for the June 8th test, and that's what I'm doing right now. And I'll be able to go to law school. I'm thinking more of environmental law, and also I want to get into like public law.
Great. That's great. We always need lawyers in any country. So do you plan on using, are you particular about where you locate after you finish law school? Is it specific to taking that back home, or does it really matter?
Right now, it doesn't really matter. I wouldn't mind staying around here in North Dakota because I'm looking at the law school here in Grand Forks. They have the Native Americans in law, and I guess they place you, like after law school, they place you at any of the five reservations. You can be like a tribal court judge or a lawyer or any of that, that would pertain to law. I think I would rather have some experience before going home and taking over.
And you're right. There's such a shortage. My husband is a North Dakota Indian Affairs Commissioner, and so I know a little bit about tribes, and just kind of generally speaking, I know that we have a shortage of judges. So that may be something you might pursue.
Yeah, that's what they're saying is that they, well, like if you graduate from there, they can like have you be a judge at any of the five reservations, or you can also work in the Bismarck, I guess the section where I guess where your husband works, somewhere in that area.
Oh, sure.
So I wouldn't mind working at any of the tribes and trying to have a feel of, like what goes on really. I'm excited and nervous at the same time and taking my test.
Yeah, I bet. It's surely a transition, and and that kind of brings bring us back to a little bit about going backwards now. We know where you are today. We kind of know where you're going. We know a little bit about you. So tell me about some of your history. Growing up, where did you grow up?
I grew up on the reservation. It's a small, tiny town. It's called Cedar Creek, Arizona. Probably like 150. The population is about 150. And there, growing up, we didn't have like any stores or anything where we could shop. We always had to go off the reservation, which is like about an hour drive both ways to get all of our groceries and everything like that.
So would you say that was it a small town or was it a an urban area that you had to drive to an hour away?
It was like an urban area.
Okay.
Like a border town. It was right off of the reservation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was mostly playing outside and like doing all the things as a little kid and going hunting with my oldest brother. I call him my brother, but he's really my cousin. Okay. So, yeah, and we had a TV, but it was like really limited. Like we couldn't, it was probably like 3 channels on there. And we didn't have cable or anything of that sort. So, but yeah, we did a lot. It was fun.
And so now today, it's hard to imagine our children to yeah. be limited with TVs and computers yeah. and all of those things. It's so different today.
It is, especially because my son, he has like an iPad and he has his Xbox and you know, like he wants to play his game and everything. And then I'm like, I tell him, I was like, you know, we only had 3 channels. He's like, Mom, you're not that old. He says I'm 17. I'm like, okay.
That's so nice. They're usually making us feel old, or my kids do anyway. So that's nice. So growing up as a child, you grew up in a very small town, 150 people. Would you say, how would you say that, what did you take from that? I know you mentioned the playing outside, but there must have been things that you learned. Were there things like your culture? Did you learn more about your culture?
On
the reservation?
Yeah, my grandma used to go out and pick like medicinal plants, you know, and she used to like show us which plants were used like for aches and pains and sore throats and stuff like that. And she used to teach us that, and that's my grandma from my dad's side. And my grandparents from my mother's side, they were really traditional. My family right now, they're the main ones who do the traditional dances back home. Like the main medicine man for our tribe, which is my cousin, is my mom's older brother's son. And my mom's older brother was the main medicine man. So there's 11 bands of Apaches, and he goes out to all the other bands, and he does their traditional dances, their ceremonies. So I learned a lot, like tradition-wise, on both sides. You know, my grandma on my dad's side, she was like a Christian, grew up in the Assemblies of God with her. And then when I'd go visit my mom's side of the family, I would go to the traditional ceremonies with them. So my mom and dad, they were married for a while, and then they divorced, and I grew up with my dad's side of the family. So I was adopted by my dad's older sister.
So how old were you at that time?
She said she got me when she was a baby, but from my mom, when I talked with my mom, she said that it was probably like when I was like 4 or 5 years old. That's when they divorced and everything, and that's when I started living with my aunt. And she's the main one who raised me. Okay. And I would see my mom, and you know, but then at the time she went back to school. She went to Texas to attend like a Bible school, and she graduated. Well, she transferred back to Arizona, and she graduated with her bachelor's degree in Arizona. And after she got her bachelor's degree, that's when I moved back in with her.
So what age were you at that time?
I was probably like 16.
Okay.
Yeah, about 15, 16 in that area. But I always, you know, went to go visit her and stuff like that, visit my grandparents. And I still was active, like, in both ways. Mm-hmm. I don't know, when people say living in both worlds, I would say, I understand what you're talking about, but this is like four. For me, there was like four ways. There was the white way, the Indian way, the traditional way, and, you know, the church way. You know what I mean?
Okay.
So I'm like, I understand it when people say that, but I sort of don't like that term also when they say when they're walking two roads. It's just like, okay.
That's very interesting. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? I think that's really interesting to break it down. Just your perspective. There's no right or wrong here.
Yeah.
It's just a learning time right now. So if you want to share that a little bit.
Okay. Like I said, that was like, for me, the way I visualize it is like four ways. The white way would be non-traditional, education first, and, you know, just staying away from culture, really. And then there is like the traditional way, and where we maintain our culture, maintain our language, and keeping up with the ceremonies. And then there's the church way, where, like, I used to go with my grandma when I was a young girl, and we attended like church services Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like strict Bible rules, you know. God mm-hmm. said this, God said that. You can't mm-hmm. you can't look at certain things on TV, and you can't say swear words, you know, stuff like that. And
mm-hmm.
and then it was just like, I think that's the part that was really confusing, is that, well, I could understand that when you say, when you go to church, you can't maintain your tradition. But for me, it was really hard because I went to both places, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't understand that when we went to church, all the ladies wore the traditional dresses, the camp dresses to church.
Mm-hmm.
And you would see that also at a traditional dance. They have all the traditional camp dresses at our ceremonies. So that was the part that was like, okay, well, if you're saying that, to forget about tradition is bad. And, you know, back then, the Assemblies of God, they would just say that all traditional and ceremonies were like devil worship, you know.
Okay.
And I actually did hear that in church, like, oh, you shouldn't go to your ceremonies, you shouldn't participate in them. That's the devil working, you know. And that was the part that was like, so does that mean that the other side of my family are devil worshippers? You know, that was really weird. And but from my point of view, I knew that both tradition, they both served God, and it was like our own way of expressing our thanks to Him.
So interesting. So the Assemblies of God's Church, they said that it was evil, basically, to practice your traditional ways of any type, like, for example, wearing the traditional dresses to church. So the women, the Indian women, wore them anyhow?
Yeah, they still wore them.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what was the church, were they acceptive of that, or did they just accept it?
They just accepted, and to this day, they still wear the dresses. It's a camp dress. They still wear it. And I think that's just one of the things that was confusing to me, was like, well, why are you still wearing this dress when you're saying it's the devil, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was like conflicting, but I've noticed that over the years they've started to get more lenient, and they're like, back home, there's a huge following to the high school basketball teams, and when there was a church, you know, the preacher would be up there and say, you cannot go to basketball games. You know, that's evil.
Going to basketball games
was evil. Going to basketball games was evil. Going to football games was evil. They were so strict. And my grandma was like so religious, and she just wouldn't let us go on our own. She was the main one that was like made, you know, the choices for us as little girls, what to do, what not to do. So I think I really liked it when I was with my mom's side of the family, because we went to the traditional dances and we did a lot more. Like, I knew, I started to question a lot of things, and I mean, there was just so many things and that really helped me out, like especially going to the traditional dances. I was able to speak my language. I was able to ask more questions and get answers, you know. So
how did you deal with the conflict that must have still been going on? Was it a so the church is telling you all these strict rules, and then, for example, the traditional dresses, the basketball games, you didn't stop going to basketball, did you?
No.
So you have to make a choice at some point, right?
Yeah, and I think after, like, becoming a teen and, you know, still going to both places, I guess you would say that during the week I would follow my grandma's rules, because she was the main one in our family that was making rules, like, we couldn't do this, we couldn't do that. But when I go see my mom's side of the family, and we'd go to, like, traditional dances, and that's when I would participate in traditional dances and whatnot. So that was, like, I did both, and I made sure to not mix them up together. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. So
that's how you navigated through life then?
Yeah. With both sides. And one of my closest friends growing up with her, she was like my neighbor. She was so against tradition. She was like, she knew like what the church wanted. And now, like, up until recently, she started going to traditional dances, and she did like four dances already, and that's all she's into. And she just says, yo, I grew up in this, when I know that, you know, I'm like, no, you didn't. But I think that since my grandma passed away, it's just like, now I'm like, my whole family, they go to wherever they want. I think she was the main one, you know, that was like, she was the prayer warrior, basically. She was, like, in church and always praying and, you know, all of that. But, yeah.
So when we say, you mentioned white way, traditional church, and then now we have the native way or the Indian way. So what would that be, or how is that different from traditional?
I think the native way, like, when I think about when people say there's two roads that they walk on, which is, like, the native way and the white way. The native way, to me, would just basically be speaking your language and, you know, just understanding where you're coming from, understanding your history. I think that there's just so many people, so many natives, that they don't know their history, or they don't want to learn about the history because they feel like they're embarrassed by it, you know what I mean? Like, they feel like they were conquered or something. But for me, I want to know all about my history, all about the Apache history. I'm interested in, you know, learning about other people's history, what they went through, and then understanding that they're still here today, you know what I mean, when we're not supposed to be here, basically. That would be, like, when people talk about two roads, that's what I think of, is like, there's the native way and then the white way. And, like, for me, I would say I had four ways, was the native way and the white way and the traditional way, and then there's the church way, you know? So it was like, I dealt with both well, all four, really.
So that could be very confusing, right?
Yeah.
Growing up. So we're talking about, I think, knowledge versus the spirituality piece?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
But like I said, it was, you know, I did everything my grandma told me to do. And, mm-hmm. you know, and some things that I didn't listen to was going to the dances and stuff like that. Which I'm glad I did, honestly, because I think for me, I know that I learned a lot. You know, mm-hmm. I learned about my culture and my language and mm-hmm. everything, like why certain plants are used and why certain trees are used in our tradition. That type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So let me just kind of back up a little bit. When you say grandma, grandma is on dad's side or mom's side?
The traditional or the...
Well, you have two grandmas. One's traditional, one is...
The traditional is my mom's side. And the one that was like strictly church was my dad's side of the family.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
So you had to balance and satisfy the two.
Yeah. The two forces.
So we develop a lot of skill sets, right?
Yeah.
We learn how to negotiate at a very young age, right? Well, that's interesting. Okay, so I guess kind of getting back to maybe a little bit of some of the challenges. Were there any other challenges? I know you mentioned you grew up on the reservation. Would that have been all the way up until you went to college? Or at what point did you ever move to the city or the urban areas?
I think in high school, I went to the boarding school out in California, the Riverside Indian School.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was my first time moving away from home. And I really liked it. I enjoyed it. I think mostly because I was always, you know, maneuvering between both sides of my family. And for me to be a whole state away and not under anybody's protective eyes or whatever, it was just like a relief, you know, like...
Freedom.
Yeah, freedom.
So I bet there was the opportunity then to be inquisitive.
Yeah.
And kind of without worried about your hand being slapped, so to say.
Yeah, basically. And I was there for about a couple of years, went to school there, and, you know, that's when I started to understand that there was a lot more Natives than Apaches, you know. Mm-hmm. I knew that there was some Navajos in Arizona. I mean, that's how tiny the city or the town that I grew up in, there was just Navajos and Hopis and Apaches, mm-hmm. and, you know, some Pima, mm-hmm. and then... going to boarding school, and there was like thousands of other Natives there, you know, mm-hmm. and I really loved it. I was like, oh, okay, we're not the only ones. I think it was sort of like empowering to know that there was a lot more.
Right. And from different tribes.
Exactly, from different tribes.
And so what, so then that brings to light that growing up, there was a sense of feeling as there's not many of us.
Yeah.
So how did that feel growing up? You grew up on the reservation before high school as a child growing up in that little town. You still interacted with non-Natives?
I think just basically teachers.
Okay.
And there was probably one little white girl that grew up on our res, and we used to play with her every once in a while. But that's basically it. Just basically... Yeah.
Teachers and maybe their children?
Yeah, teachers and their children. But their children were older.
Oh, okay.
So you hardly see them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was really an experience, and you were exposed then when you went to Riverside, probably more so to the non-Natives as well?
Yeah, more to Hispanics, you know, and because they were all over. Like in L.A., we used to go off campus, and we used to see them everywhere. So it was exciting. Just to be able to experience all, I guess you could say it was a culture shock at first, you know, and
I bet.
Yeah. But I grew accustomed to it, and I'm glad that I got a chance to go off, you know, off to the boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
It was different, and it, like, we had to get up early and scrub the floors. But I enjoyed it. You know what I mean? I think it was just the fact that I was out there by myself. I think that's the one part that I liked. And one thing that I did started to like experiment was like with alcohol, because it was never available for me. It was always available at traditional dances, like when people help, you know, they would give it to them or all of that, but I just never did because I was like so scared of, you know, it was so strict of what I was supposed to do, what I was not supposed to do. So,
and you mean on both sides?
Yeah, on both sides, and traditional and the church side. But I never got like all into it, like, you know, go out every weekend or whatever, up until like after I graduated. And that's when, like, going to college, well, I went to Riverside, and then I transferred back home because my grandma and my grandpa, they were both dying of alcoholism. And so I wanted to be there, you know what I mean, like to actually say goodbye or whatever and just be there closer to home. So I came home, and my grandma passed away, and then I graduated from high school. It was, like, really hard, but because just seeing somebody, like somebody who's strong, and to see her, like, just crumble like that, that was so hard. And even though that you knew that she died from alcohol, it was still, like, available, you know what I mean? Like, you still know it's there, and I would go out with my friends and stuff, and to me, I was like, oh, that's never going to be me type of deal, you know? It was like, I still can't get it today that there's so many people dying on our reservation and they know it's because of the alcohol, but it's like their own kids, their own mom, their own dad, they're still doing the same thing, and that's like the addiction, you know what I mean? And I just wonder sometimes, like, do they really know that that same thing that they're doing is what, you know, is killing off everybody else? That's the part that's... But then again, they just can't get away from it, from, you know, like, addiction, really. But,
it's hard to watch.
It is.
The same thing over and over when you can clearly see that it's killing them. So you question if they understand that or not.
Exactly.
I think they probably want to, but like you said, you know, the addiction, it's baffling.
I
don't understand why, I think, themselves, why they do it. And I just speak to that a little bit with my past experience with alcoholism, and it's really kind of a nightmare. You just can't wake up. You know, and you just trying to, you wish you knew how to get out, and it can just take you deeper and deeper sometimes. And so I think sometimes people just don't come back. You know, some make it, and, you know, those are the stories that we want to capture as to how did they get beyond that? How did they make it? What was the, you know, the aha moment for them, or what brought them through it?
I think for me, like I said, I graduated and I went to U of A, and that was like a lot more, like a little bit more of a culture shock than when going to Riverside, because Riverside, it was all natives, and outside the fence was, you know, the different whites, blacks, and whatnot. But going to U of A, it was just like one classroom, you had like 500 people in there, you know? And it was just all general courses. It was like so many people and just everything. And that's when I started hanging out with a lot more people, and we started going out, and we started going to Mexico, because it was just like an hour drive, and it was so easy to go over there and like all the clubs and whatever. And I think that's when I started, like, to me, it was social drinking, you know, going out and whatever. And then it got so bad, my grades were so bad, and I was like, well, I better go home, because I couldn't, you know, I couldn't do my grade, I couldn't do my work, and like go to class, because I was out doing everything else that I was not supposed to be doing. So I went home and I got a job, and but it continued. Like when I went home, like my friends were like, "Let's go out, let's do this," and I'd be like, "Okay." And it was like it started to get every weekend. We started going out and getting drunk and all of that. Mm-hmm. And one night, I dropped off everybody and I went back home, and I woke up and I was like in a ditch, mm-hmm. and I had totaled my car, mm-hmm. and I guess I fell asleep driving back home, and I lived 22 miles from my friend's house to my place, and I don't know how long I was there, but I was ejected out of my car. I was the only one there, and some people that were going home early in the morning, they found me, and they just saw my car and they couldn't find me, mm-hmm. and they were like wondering like what happened to these people, or you know, where did they go, or they were like thinking that maybe after the accident maybe they ran off, mm-hmm. that was their assumption, but mm-hmm. they didn't see me there, mm-hmm. until the ambulance and like everybody came, like just they all rushed to the scene, and they were like searching around all over the place, and they saw me, and I don't remember, and mm-hmm. they took me into the hospital. They had me checked all over. They said I was fine, and that's when I was like, you know, holy crap, what's going on, you know? And
mm-hmm. that was an eye opener for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it was like I just thought that it was something that I could control, mm-hmm. you know, and I thought that, oh, it's nothing type of deal. And that's when I realized, like, I think that I should stop this. And the next morning, like, my mom and, you know, everybody came and they were just crying and hugging me. And mm-hmm. I was like, why are you guys crying? And I was mad, like, because they were just crying and, like, hugging me. And at the time, I was just like, I'm not dead, you know, and I just mm-hmm. felt like to me, they were like pretending, or like they were just thinking I was gone or something. Mm-hmm. But after I got out of the hospital, we went back to the car. Like they drove me to the wreckage place, mm-hmm. and my car was like so like a can that was just crumbled up, mm-hmm. and it just looked like there was just no way anybody could get out of there, mm-hmm. like it was just like in a ball, mm-hmm. and they're like, look at that.
So it's a miracle.
I just,
my goodness.
Yeah,
well, we're so thankful that you're here. You have a story to tell people.
I know, this is, and just when I think about it right now, it's just like, I just think about it and that's like, oh my God. And I walked out of there, like mm-hmm. the same morning, I guess you could say. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God.
So that's where I think that's the spiritual part of it, would you say?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. And I guess, the doctors were like, upset, and they were like, you are so lucky to be alive. You know, they were like, I was like, but I didn't really get it at the hospital, you know, because I was like, oh, I'm still alive, why are you guys crying, you know? Uh-huh. But I guess seeing the car and seeing all of that, I think that's the part that I just couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. I had no broken bones. I had nothing. The only thing that I got from my wreck was this little tiny scar. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the only thing that I could actually say that happened. I mean, that you can't even tell, you know?
It's barely there.
Yeah.
Compared to a totaled car.
Yeah, like, the car is just completely gone. And I think that was, like, an eye-opener right there. I was like, oh my God, you know, I didn't, to me, it wasn't, I guess, before my wreck or whatever, I didn't think it was that bad, mm-hmm. you know, I was just like, oh, it's, you know, nothing. I could do it and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't believe it. I was like, oh my God, I just cannot believe that happened. And
mm-hmm.
I just stayed away from my friends, and it probably lasted about a month, you know?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it was like, okay, let's go out and do something. Yeah. And I was like, I probably, like, for a couple weeks, we went out and went to bars and stuff like that, but
mm-hmm.
that always stuck in my head,
mm-hmm.
you know, and people would say that too, like, wow, I cannot believe that you survived, and I saw the car, I saw your car, and we, you know, we prayed for you, and we just couldn't believe that you got out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that whenever I saw people, they would say that to me, and it would just bring me back to the reality that I survived something that bad. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's when I started wanting to change, and mm-hmm. that's when I realized that, you know, there was a purpose for me,
mm-hmm.
and I knew that I could have been gone, and, you know, that would have been, like, the end of me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's when I realized that, okay, I'm sure God has a plan for me, and I have to abide by His rules,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I was determined, like, if this happened on the res, I'm gonna have to get off the res or something. I mean, I prayed about it. I was like, God, I don't want to be here. Just let me go somewhere. I know that, you know, I had the friends there that, you know, that were so persuasive, you know, and right. I had to get away from them. Like,
yeah.
And I knew that when they asked me, I'd be like, oh, okay, let's go. Mm-hmm. That type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. and then He opened up a way for me to get back into University of Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
I got a letter one day, and it said, you know, congratulations. And I was so happy. I was like, oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I had to leave the reservation.
Mm-hmm.
I left, but I went back to University of Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And Gene was in the same boat. He was, you know, drinking and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to come with me. I told him I couldn't. I mm-hmm. said, I can't take you. I said, you know, I have to go. I told him, if I stay here, I know, you know, the same old thing's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be like a continuous cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So he was like, you know, mad at me, and, you know.
You guys, like, were dating?
Yeah, we were dating at the time. And he was upset, saying, you know, how come you don't let me do, you don't want me to go with you and whatnot. And I was like, I can't.
Mm-hmm.
So I left him there back home, and I left, and I was. And then,
can I ask, what age were you by this point?
This was probably 19, 20, about in that area. 19, 20. Yeah, 19, okay. 20. So
you were still really young.
Yeah.
So you're giving it a second shot, and you went back to college?
Yeah, I went back. But this time around, I had to pay on my own.
Mm, okay.
You know, there was no scholarships available for me. There was no Pell Grant.
Mm-hmm.
Because I messed up the first time, you know, like, with my financial aid and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I was working full-time at the Desert Diamond Casino down in Tucson. I would work from 11 o'clock at night to 7 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And during the day, my classes would start at 9 o'clock a.m., and wouldn't be done until about 3.
Okay.
And I think that was the part that was just so hard, was just going full time on both work and school.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you succeed? Were you able to graduate?
No, I wasn't able to graduate. Okay. And that's the part that really got to me, was I was a semester away from getting my bachelor's in for psychology.
Okay.
My last semester there, I think I felt like I was burnt out, just continuous, like, going to work at 11, getting off at 7, getting ready for school, 9 o'clock, all the way until 3. And I just started work just full time. I was like, I can't do this. I need to, you know, just bills and everything. I that's what the one thing that I said was really bothering me.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't go to school for a long time after that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, you know, in between that time, Gina and I, we got married. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any kids for a long time. Mm-hmm. His mom got Alzheimer's. And to me, I feel as though that the reason why we didn't have any kids early on was because we were taking care of his mom. Mm-hmm. We were going to take care of his mom.
Mm-hmm.
She was a nurse. She was the first Native American nurse for our tribe, you know, the Apache nurse. And she just, like, broke so many grounds on a lot of things, the programs and whatnot down there.
Mm-hmm.
And she started to get forgetful. Mm-hmm. She couldn't remember where she put her keys. She couldn't remember where she put her money. Everything of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And so people were like, oh, you guys are married. You guys don't have any kids. You know, you can take care of her.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So she moved in with us, and it was really hard because she just couldn't remember anything.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes she would be up for like 72 hours continuously. She wouldn't go to sleep. And she would cry and cry for hours. And I would go to sleep and Jay would be with her.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I wake up, I would be with her and he would go to sleep. So it was like a cycle like that also.
Mm-hmm.
We never got any help from her brothers, her sisters. Nobody did. It was just the two of us working basically 24 hours. Mm-hmm. We, at the time, we were working for FedEx.
Mm-hmm.
We were customer service there, and it was a really good job. I liked working there.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to quit, you know, and take care of her full time.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, we started looking into homes for her.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that was one of the main things that was frustrating, was that there was no help for Natives, like in Alzheimer's department, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There was just so many papers to sign, so many, just the whole health system about the whole thing just really opened our eyes. Since she was a nurse, she made too much for her to be put on public assistance.
Mm-hmm.
And she made too little to be put into a private home. Mm-hmm. So she was like somewhere in the middle to where she was making too little and then she was making too much.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like, well, she was a nurse. Isn't there any way anybody can help her? But mm-hmm. It was just so hard.
So I just have to ask, she was a nurse. Was she a nurse for IHS?
Yeah, she was a nurse for IHS.
Okay. And there wasn't financial assistance?
No, there was no financial assistance. There was just, we went to conferences for Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
They had so many pamphlets about all, you know, whites, blacks, Hispanics.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it came to Native Americans, all it said was little Native Americans research currently being done. And that was it. Just like one tiny, nothing. They had absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't like call anybody to say, well, what's, you know, what are we going to do?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, these are all challenges that that kind of keep you from being able to focus on your own life and moving forward. At what point did you say, okay, it's time to do something with my life? At what point, what age and what got you there?
I think after his mom passed away from Alzheimer's and everything, we started working again and we started our own company, Native organization.
Okay.
And we didn't know how to run a business,
mm-hmm.
didn't know how to do inventory, didn't know how to do accounting, mm-hmm. but we just did it. Mm-hmm. We went all over the U.S. selling, all over the West Coast, up to Washington, like every Powell's, everything we hit. Mm-hmm. We sold T-shirts and CDs and just everything, you know? Mm-hmm. And we sold at Crow Fair. And then, well, when 4 years, 5 years ago, that's when we wanted to go to Gallup International. It's like a whole gathering of people down in Gallup, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. So we packed up our clothes for the weekend, locked our doors, locked our windows. We got Preston at our son. He was probably 1.5 at the time. Mm-hmm. Got him like 2 weeks of clothes, and Gina and I, we got like a week's worth of clothes, you know, traveling clothes to go out to Gallup ceremonials and come back. Mm-hmm. So we packed up our trailer, we packed up our truck, and we went to Gallup ceremonials. And then when we were there, Gene kept getting a text, come to Crow Fair, come to Crow Fair, I got a booth, mm-hmm. come share with me. It was one of our friends. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you want to go? I was like, yeah, sure. Uh-huh. And so, but before that, I mean, we got everything into the trailer at home. I was walking out the door, and all our files and everything, and I just happened to look, and there was like a folder. Mm-hmm. Everything was in there, our birth certificates, our social, marriage license, I mean, anything you can think of. And just that split second, I grabbed it, I walked out the door, locked, and we went to Gallup ceremonials. And then he's like, okay, let's go to Crow Fair. It's like, okay, so we went to Crow Fair. We started traveling to Crow Fair. Mm-hmm. I'd say about an hour out of Crow Fair, somewhere in Buffalo, our transmission went out. Mm-hmm. And we crawled into Crow Fair, mm-hmm. sold all weekend. Mm-hmm. And we're like, okay, we'll get our transmission with the money we make and we'll go. Mm-hmm. But we never made it. We had everything lined up. We got the mechanic to do it. The transmission was ready. Mm-hmm. But come to find out, it was a different transmission, and they couldn't do anything about it. Oh, no. So from Crow Fair, we got a, I want to say an RV. It's not an RV. A U-Haul truck. We threw everything in there, mm-hmm. and we met some people. They said, come to Rosebud. You guys will make a lot of money. Go to Rosebud. So we're like, okay, we'll leave the truck here in Crow. We left it at one of our friends' place in Montana. We traveled to Rosebud. After Rosebud Fair, we did it okay. And then the guy was like, you know what? There's two more powwows. There is the Cheyenne River Fair and powwow. And there's the United Tribes Technical College powwow. You guys should come. And we're like, what is that? Because we've never heard of United Tribes. Mm-hmm. And they're like, just come. It's a college. It's a native college. It's called the International Powwow. There's a lot of people. And then we're like, okay. So we're like, we'll try Cheyenne. We won't plan for United Tribes. So we went to Cheyenne. We did okay, but not enough to get our transmission back running. Mm-hmm. And all this time, we're in our U-Haul. Mm-hmm. They're charging us with mileage. And the gas is outrageous, and at the time it was like $5 a gallon. Mm-hmm. And we went to Cheyenne, same story. We got enough to get to the next spot, which was United Tribes.
Uh-huh. In the U-Haul.
Okay. Everything was just me, Jean, and Preston. Mm-hmm. And the guy that we were following, mm-hmm. go to United Tribes, you'll do good. It's a lot of young people, they'll buy a lot of stuff, and you guys will do good. Uh-huh. And we're like, okay, we'll try it. And we were laughing and joking, ha ha, it's a college, we're going to enroll, you know? We're like, we're just going to stay, you know? But we were teasing each other. Uh-huh. We're going to enroll, we're going to do it. And we got to Bismarck on a Wednesday, mm-hmm. and the funny thing was they set us up right in front of the admissions building. Like, the admissions building, and we were, like, right there, our tent. Okay. Everything was there. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm going to go in there. I'm going to go check it out. Because mm-hmm. we were done setting up, and I went in, and Vivian was working, and she's like, oh, how are you doing? You know, she was really nice and talking to me and friendly, whatever. And, yeah, I was like, oh, yeah, we're just here. I'm just checking it out. And she's like, oh, okay, well, applications are due on Friday at 4:30. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, you know. I was like, oh, I'll get two of them. And she's like, oh, okay. So she gave me two. And I walked out, and I showed it to Gene. I was like, look what I got. And he's like, what's that for?
Something just pulled you in there?
Yeah.
It was just not intentional. It was just kind of spur of the moment.
Yeah, spur of the moment. Wow. And just the fact that it was just right there, you know. Mm-hmm. Went in there, they got it. Thursday, I filled out all my information for the application. I gave Gene, you know, I gave him his application, but he never filled it out or nothing. Mm-hmm. Friday, I hung on to it all day. I just was like, you know, wow, it's so weird. And 4 o'clock came, and I was like, oh, it's due in half an hour, you know. Mm-hmm. I was like, I can't believe this. And mm-hmm. I told Gene, I said, I'm going to go turn this in. And he's like, why? He's like, what are you doing? So I walked in there probably like 4:15, and she was still working. And I was like, oh, I brought back my application. And I took my folder that I just grabbed off the, like, when we left. And mm-hmm. she's like, I need this, 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 and this, and this. And I looked in that folder, and everything was there in order the way she wanted it. And wow. I took it out, and I was like, there it is. Yeah. And she was like, okay, you're good. And, you know.
Just like it was meant to be.
Yeah. It was the plan. It was so crazy. Yeah. And then all weekend, I just couldn't believe it. And then Julie came, and because we knew her from a while back. And she was like, are you guys really, you know, you guys really want to go to college? And mm-hmm. we're like, we've been talking about it. Mm-hmm. She's like, let me know. She goes, come by on Monday. And Jean was like, I don't know, you know. We just barely got 2 weeks of clothes, and mm-hmm. all our house, our, just everything. Just imagine walking out of your house thinking you're going to leave for the weekend. Mm-hmm. Just locking it up and not going back. That was us. Mm-hmm. And I went in to see her on Monday. And we walked around campus. And that Wednesday I was in class.
Wow. Just like that. Did you and got housing? Everything?
Yeah. Like they gave us a room at the hotel.
Okay.
The Expressway Inn or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they gave us a place at Washington Court.
Okay.
But it was just like when we got into Washington Court, we didn't have anything. Mm-hmm. We just had trash bags, like, mm-hmm. full of clothes. And when I look at the pictures, I was just talking about it this morning. I was, like, so amazed. But we were looking at the pictures from 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. All we had was the bed that Tribes gave us, yeah. and like an old ugly big TV that our friend gave us because she was going to throw it away. You know, it's really huge, one of those really big ones, and it was sitting right in front of the bed, and Preston was sitting there in front of it. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe that. Like 4 years just came and went, you know. We didn't even go home for a whole year.
Uh-huh.
We stayed that whole time. People were like, Bismarck? You guys are in Bismarck? You're like, yes, we're in Bismarck. And they just couldn't believe it that we left only for the weekend and we were gone this whole time and we're still gone, gosh. You know?
It was time to make a move. I guess it was a plan.
Yeah, right? That's my belief is that, mm-hmm. that it was all in God's plan for me. Mm-hmm. For us to be here, for us, because I've always prayed about my education. Mm-hmm. I hated it that I never finished at U of A. I was like a semester away, and it just bothered me that, I cannot believe I didn't finish. I can't believe I didn't get my degree. Mm-hmm. And then I when we were at home, I just, one night, I remember just crying out, and I was like, I don't like it here. I don't like living on the res. Mm-hmm. I don't like living in this house. I don't like having to go run around for, you know, filling out applications and not getting no calls back, you know?
Yeah.
And the only way you can get a job on the reservation is if you know somebody mm-hmm. or if you're related to them.
Oh, yeah.
And mm-hmm. education doesn't play a role when you're on the reservation. Mm-hmm. So, but I remember my specific prayer was that I just need to get an education. I need to get out of the reservation. And I feel as though like these last 4 years was like God's way of making me know that he knew he was listening. He wanted me to know that he was listening, mm-hmm. you know? And that's how we ended up here. And that's how I ended up grabbing the folder that had everything in order that Vivian wanted the day I turned in my application. And it still blows my mind. I'm like, I'm graduating in May.
You know, that is just, I'm just in tears because that's just, it is a miracle. That the whole story, it's a miracle from making it through the car accident that you were at to allow you the opportunity to keep trying to get it right.
Yeah.
You know, I think, and it just shows God's grace, and I think that's why I'm crying because I just see how he worked in your guys' life, and it's just powerful. And if you had something to say to somebody listening who isn't there yet, and maybe they're just trying to find their way, and whatever that may be, what would you say to them?
I would just say never give up. Just pray, because you know, I didn't know that God was listening to me. Mm-hmm. And to just not judge on if it's traditional way or the church way or anything, just always know that it's a relationship between you and God.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for this, for sharing your story. And I know it's not always easy to humble ourselves when we know it's going to be shared on public radio. So I really appreciate sharing your story and your family's story with us. It's going to change lives. Thank you.
Thank you.